This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Ewan McElraith from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. In this podcast, myself, Mark Stephen, and Ewan McElraith are going to continue our journey along Scotland's longest river, the Tay. Now, last summer we made it to Dunkeld, so we're going to start a little further downstream at Capeth.
I just love the sound of running water. I am trying not to grin like a schoolboy because it's just one of those pitch-perfect mornings, bang smack in the centre of Scotland. Hello from the banks of the River Tay. We are continuing the journey we started last year, where we made it from Killin down to Dunkeld, following the Tay, which is Scotland's longest river.
Yeah, we moved a couple of miles downstream to the Capeth Bridge, the starting point for the programme. Remember, we're not live, but you can email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. And if there ever was a cliche for a fishing section of a programme, this is it.
Yes, a fisherman's hut just up behind us. There is a very, very old rowing boat just tied beside us with the most perfect wee anchor further up on the bank. It's so pretty here too, because I mean there's big swathes, clouds of angelica. You know, that white umbellifer, there's comfrey, there's lupin here for some reason. I don't entirely understand that.
Well, it drifts out of people's gardens onto the river and plants itself and seeds all the way down the river. But there's oyster catchers behind us, a couple of dippers going past, there's a wagtail, there's a thrush on the other side. I don't know if you can hear that.
Yeah, I can. I'm quite surprised too how wide the river is here.
It's huge. The River Tay is always one that amazes me, just the sheer size of it and the colour and the foam. It's one of those brilliant places to start a programme.
Yeah, not too straight. Beautiful. The Tay is known the world over as being a top salmon fishing river. And 100 years ago, very near where we're standing today, the biggest salmon ever to be caught on rod and line in British waters was caught by a lady called Georgina Ballantyne. Now, Dr. David Summers is fisheries director with the Tay River, and he knows the story well.
Georgina Ballantyne lived in this cottage here, where her father was or had been the ferryman across the river, as I understand it, and she was the ferryman's daughter. And on the 7th of October 1922, late in the afternoon, they were fishing just out here. In fact, they were way up there above. You can see that stone up there. They call that the Bargee Stone. Yeah. And they were fishing just about above there, and according to her report afterwards, her father expected that they might get some fish here, that all the rest of the people that had been fishing had gone off, and they hooked this salmon just before dark up just above that stone, literally a few hundred yards above where we're standing.
What did she have on the line?
Well, it was something, I mean, it called a dace. Now, I'm not entirely sure whether this was a type of a spinner or whether it was an actual fish, a preserved fish that was then mounted on a spinning mount. Mm-hmm. And indeed, in those days, that was a sort of popular thing. They had sprats and all sorts of fish.
But they actually fish with like a pickled fish at the end of the line.
Not only just pickled, some of them might be dyed in sort of gold dye or something like that.
But they quickly realised they're a big fish.
Yes, apparently they did. And as I understand it, they played it for over 2 hours and it ran away from way up there, way, way down below where the bridge is now, down into this long section called Sparramure. So, there were several hundred yards below us over 2 hours later before they actually managed to land it.
How big was it?
64 pounds.
That's enormous.
It is.
That must have taken some skill, though, because if it's hurtling down there and it's hurtling up there, odds on it's going to break the line.
Well, I mean, well, obviously what you do when you're playing a salmon, when the fish runs, it, you give it line, so it took out what's a spear line. I think they might have been in the bank, had to go in the bank at one stage. So they would run down after, it wouldn't just stand there. You go with the fish.
I've read Georgina Ballantyne's account of this, and of course, you know, she's a lassie in the boat, and her father's in the boat. And the way she describes the conversation, it's just every family that you would ever expect. You're doing this wrong, you're not doing it right. Hurry up, do it a different way.
So obviously he was getting really kind of worked up and ratty about the whole thing, fearing that they were going to lose it.
The fish is probably getting tireder now. How did they actually get it out of the water? I mean, the sensation must have been incredible.
But well, as I understand it, well, as was typical in those days, they gaffed the fish.
Which means what?
Well, a gaff is a sort of great big hook without a barb on it. You know, it's several feet long, a shaft with a hook that's several inches across. And these are sort of typical things, that not just for catching salmon, but cod and lines and this sort of thing. And you had this big hook which you just stuck into the fish's body effectively and yanked at the shore.
How did the local male anglers react to the fact that this wee lassie had smashed the record?
Well, I'm sure that some of them, their egos must have been bruised, I have no doubt. And then I think in those days there would have been a lot more women actually went fishing in the day in those days than would have been more typical in recent decades. You know, when people parties came up here in the autumn for their hunting holiday, as it were, I think, you know, often quite a lot of the men would have gone away out stalking and this sort of thing, and the sort of boys and the girls and the women were put on the river because they were put in the boat, basically, and the gilly would row, and they would wait for the fish to take.
What on earth do you do with 64 pounds of prime salmon?
Well, with this one, as I understand it, they donated to the Royal Infirmary or something in Perth, so that the fish was, I believe, was taken to the hospital and cut up and fed to the patients. One of the interesting things about salmon is everybody is aware that there are less salmon now, that salmon numbers have been declining. But what we've been seeing, and it's becoming more and more obvious, and this year has been really quite telling, that for about the last 15 years, particularly in the spring, we've been seeing bigger fish again. And this is always kind of story I would like to tell you. So in the 1920s, in that sort of period, salmon spent a relatively long time at sea, not just here, but all over. And they spent several years at sea before they came back, on average. But this sort of changed after in the 60s and 70s, and most fish came back as what we call grilse, after only a year at sea. They're smaller. They were maturing earlier. But in the last 15 years, we've been seeing bigger salmon. In this year, there's, that I know of, about three fish were caught in March over 30 pounds. And my guess is if we get three fish in March over 30 pounds, come this summer, there will be a 40-pounder in this river. It may be that in the future, somebody might get a fish to equal Miss Ballantyne's. That would be a thought.
Dr. David Summers there in the story of Georgina Ballantyne.
Fascinating stuff, and just being on the very spot, and I can't even imagine what that's like, but suddenly realising you've got a monster that's screaming up the river. That reel's whirling and boiling in her hands. It must have been quite a sensation.
In her own account, she says they paid out 150 yards a line.
Wow.
That's almost impossible.
You can imagine her hurtling down in the boat down the river. But
and her father rowing like Billy.
Oh, but the fact that the big fish are coming back, that's just great news.
No, it's excellent news. We are going to move now from, we're at Capeth, but we're going to move further down the River Tay, and we're going to end up in a place called Lunkerty, where they're working on, well, effectively joining the dots.
My name's Andy Barry. I work for Perth and Kinross Countryside Trust, and we're on a little part of what's going to be a new long-distance trail called the River Tay Way.
It is in the nature of long-distance trails to go from somewhere to somewhere. So what's your thoughts?
Yeah, well, that's very much what the River Tay Way is about. It takes you on a journey starting in Kenmore at Loch Tay all the way to Perth, passing all sorts of amazing countryside and historical sites along the way. there's a walking route and a cycling route. Just coming down to the mighty River Tay here.
If what we're walking on at the moment is like a sort of blazed track, you know, I'd be quite happy doing that, either on foot or on a bike. Uh-huh. But thinking of the terrain, running from Kenmore to Perth, there's going to be lots of chunks where there are no paths.
It's quite mixed terrain. It will require a reasonable level of fitness. We are looking to do some interesting ideas, such as between Aberfeldy and Kenmore, you've got the option to hire an electric bike. Uh-huh. So that allows much easier transportation through this large forested section, through Griffin Forest, Craigvinian, pops out at the Hermitage in Dunkeld. Mm-hmm. Makes it very easy. It follows existing paths such as this, so they already exist. All we need to do is to brand it with our River Tay Way logo, and we're working with lots of different partners, including Sustrans. We've got a project to try and connect Stanley to Lunkerty, and that's about a 3 kilometre new cycle path. Mm-hmm. So part of what we're doing is working on projects that are worthy of their own right, so they're not just part of this River Tay Way project, but that will link Stanley to Lunkerty and allow more opportunities for active travel.
What we're walking through at the moment is perfect, absolutely pitch perfect. It's very green, you know, it's spring, leaves are just out on the trees, you can hear the birds singing, there's thrushes everywhere, which is a great thing to see. But how much of this, what would it be, about 50 miles, is actually yeah. going to be on road?
Very little. It's mostly paths like this. We'll mm-hmm. go down here, we can get a view of the river. Forest trails, if we can get our, for example, the cycle path built, that will be a 3 metre wide, multi-use, sealed surface. Mm-hmm. So it's a variety, but it is really, pretty much you need to have a reasonable degree of fitness to take on.
It's not the fitness that worries me, it's just, I mean, we've done trails in the past. Mm-hmm. As said, when you're off-road, this is absolutely perfect. You can relax. And then when you get back onto a road, it comes as a terrible, terrible shock.
We're trying to minimise the road walking to the absolute minimum.
Yeah.
The beauty of this project is that it links up these villages and towns and historical places and fantastic countryside, so it gives just more options for visitors.
And what's the timescale for this? When are you going to have this finished?
We do hope to get the route waymarked and opened in the summertime. It's 50 miles, the walking route. We've got posts out and about, and we can just add our waymarker logos to it, which will help people to follow the route.
Are they going to be proper waymarkers, or are there going to be a lot of them? Because Mark and I have done quite a few in various countries and got lost every time.
We're hopeless. Seriously, you know, there's something about our brains that means we can't see waymarkers.
The John Muir Way, there we are going along that line. There's a mark there. Yeah. And then it disappears.
Yes. It's very difficult. I mean, particularly if you're chatting at a junction, it is possible to miss waymarkers. I mean, I manage the Catran Trail, which is one of Scotland's great trails, and that's in Perthshire. So we've got quite a bit of experience of managing long-distance routes, and I know that issue. I've heard it on the Catran Trail. People get lost, and you have to put in additional signs at some junctions, just seem to be a bit jinxed.
But this will be easier because it follows the river. It's going to be really, really difficult to lose. You've got that look on your face.
Yeah, well, sadly, we're not able to follow the river all the way because some of the sort of private fishing beats don't have the core paths running on them, and the core paths are the designated routes, similar rights to a right of way, if you like, and we're following the core path network. We're fortunate in Perth and Kinross. I think we've got the biggest core path network of any local authority. So there are a really good network of existing paths that are predominantly signposted already. Mm-hmm. There's just a huge network. So by branding it the River Tay Way and promoting it on a map, it should be possible to follow a specific set of core paths that eventually get you to Perth.
Andy Barry and the new proposed Crannog to VA.
It's going to be quite a trail, but he's got a lot of work in front of him.
You're listening to BBC Radio Scotland. This is Out of Doors. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElrath. We are not live this morning. Instead, we're following the River Tay from Capeth to Dundee.
Yeah, at the moment, we're just about to head to the fair city of Perth, and there's lots more to cram in as we visit Moncrieff Island, home to allotments and an 18-hole golf course, plus we actually get into the water with some of the canoes.
I'd rather get on the water in some canoes, if it's all the same to you.
Well, we've got a proud record of getting into the water.
No, you have a proud record of getting into the water. We've made it as far as Perth. It's a little bit noisier than the tranquil locations we've been so far, but of course, the Tay has also been important historically in terms of trade and industry, and which is why we're heading to Perth Harbour to meet up with Fraser Wallace, the harbour manager.
Okay, so that's us entering into the harbour operations area now from the office.
You don't expect to find a harbour for, you know, it's quite common in Europe, mainland Europe, but you don't expect to find a harbour on a river inland in this country.
Absolutely, yeah. Perth Harbour itself is one of the last remaining inland harbours around the UK. We're situated 22 miles from Dundee up here to Perth. So yes, we're one of the last ones remaining.
And how long has this been established here?
The long history of Perth Harbour dates back to David I in 1100s. Uh-huh. There was the original harbour up near Perth city centre itself. The harbour we're standing in now was designed by Robert Stephenson.
He got a boat, didn't he?
He did, yes. And so that was near the 1600s. So that's the design of where the harbour is just now.
So effectively, it's almost as if there's a like a dog leg off the river itself.
That's right. So geographically, if you're looking top down onto the river itself, coming up from Dundee, past the Fryerton Bridge and approaching in into Perth, as we can see as we look out onto the River Tay just now, vessels coming around the final corner there. Predominantly vessels all turn in the River Tay and then they'll back into the harbour here itself.
So what were they bringing in the early days? What was the cargo?
Back in the early days, looking back at historical records, there was a lot of cargo coming over from Europe, geographically, obviously across the North Sea from Europe. Tans, coal, materials for shipbuilding, timber, all these kind of things would come across from Scandinavia and the wider European area.
And how about nowadays? Because I mean, I have seen what I think is quite large ships coming up here.
Yeah, even small ships relatively look quite big on the River Tay as they come up here. So at the moment, the main cargoes we bring into Perth are timber for the house building industry, and we have soya protein cargoes and fish meal, which are all ingredients into wider animal feed products.
I presume it makes as much sense today as it did when it was started, because you're right in the heart of Scotland rather than unloading in Dundee and then transporting.
That's right, and especially nowadays, companies are trying to tick more of the environmental boxes, and being able to reduce the road haulage miles from the likes of Dundee, as you mentioned there, by the vessels coming all the way up to Perth, takes a large number of trucks off the roads. So long term, looking after the infrastructure, the roads better, but reducing that environmental impact in local areas like Dundee itself. The good thing there is, you know, we can also support local haulage industry as well, because at the end of the day, trucks are required to get the product to the final destination, which is good for Perth.
How tidal is this?
We have a tidal range here of between 3 and 4 metres.
So you bring them in on one day and get rid of them on the next?
That's the most efficient way of doing so, yeah, and that's what we try to aim to achieve, obviously. So the vessel comes up almost on a bubble of the tide, if you like, up from Dundee up to Perth, and then cargo operations will carry on as the tide goes out and starts coming back in again, and then we'll hopefully get them away on the next tide.
What about the amount of ships that are coming in? Is that increasing or decreasing, staying steady?
So to give you a bit of background for Perth Harbour is still owned by Perth and Kinross Council. Ourselves at Calmac Harbours, We operate the port on behalf of the council, and one of our tasks is to support the council in increasing the amount of cargo tonnage coming through the harbour. So when we took over here in 2018, there was approximately 5,000 tonnes of product coming through, but we've got that up to 25 to 30,000 tonnes annually now. So there's been a big increase. And one of the things we've done is, you know, identified what that brings to Perth and Kinross and the surrounding area in terms of supporting local jobs and bringing in wider economical impacts. And Perth Harbour, after a study, we can demonstrate, you know, supporting around £4 million into the local economy by keeping it operating here.
So do you do leisure boats here as well?
The River Tay is, you know, full of leisure vessels. We interact quite a lot with the leisure vessel community. We've got to from a safety point of view, but also just there are sort of eyes and ears out there in the areas of the rivers we can't get in and out of. So, yes, there's a lot of leisure users, but the harbour itself here, we don't have any leisure vessels coming in and out.
I just, you know, obviously this isn't the same place it was as it was in medieval times. Yeah. I find this fascinating that, you know, you could be standing literally in the heart of Scotland, mm-hmm. and you have clear lines of communication right across the Baltic, the North Sea, everything yes. else.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. You know, we obviously like to see trade increase and support the council in doing that. But again, we're restricted in drafts for vessels coming up here. Obviously, with it being a river, banks and things shallow up and stuff, so there's a lot of work that goes on in the background to keep the safety of navigation for the vessels coming up here to Perth.
Presumably you are limited to size because it is quite a smallish harbour.
Yeah, absolutely. In comparison to Dundee, the size of vessels we can accept here is smaller. However, they are more efficient. It means we can get the cargo on and off quicker because we are concentrating on a smaller amount of vessels. So our maximum vessel size here is up to 100 metres. But as I was saying earlier, we're very restricted on the draft. So we look at the tides and then we work out what our draft
so
can be.
So do you have to compete?
There.
I mean, do you go out there actively seeking people with that size of boat? Or how does it work?
How it works is there's a number of different ways, really. But the most predominant way is that we'll go out there speaking to companies who may be wanting to import things and see how we can help support them and maybe reducing costs or ticking more environmental boxes. And then we'll be liaising with shipping agents as well. They'll support and looking for a specific vessel that can fit up to here to Perth. And that's kind of where the ball starts to roll. And then we look at incorporating local businesses here at Perth to see how that will benefit them at the same time.
I'm not being funny here, but there is a certain irony. Because you are around the corner from the river, you've got a really rubbish view of the river.
Yes, we do. We do. Just in the background here, we've got a harbour tug that we operate here as well. And it's certainly on a day like today, a nice day, it's nice to take a trip down out in the river. We've got various checks we need to do on a monthly, so we do.
Any excuse.
Yes. Certainly the view from the window is not great, but I must say the River Tay working here is a fantastic river, and I think it's, you know, one of the nicest harbour authorities I think there probably is in the UK.
Fraser Wallace there from Perth Harbour, 22 miles inland.
It's amazing. I knew there was a port, but it's a lovely little thing. And the fact that whole getting the food miles down or the wood miles down, it's just a great idea. You're right in the centre of Scotland. Makes sense.
We're right in the centre of Perth, which is right in the centre of Scotland. And they've built up flood defences because Perth famously floods with monotonous regularity. There's a bridge just along there. You can see that arch bridge. There's a plaque which is about 4 or 5 feet above my head, which shows the highest point where the flood actually
And it's
reached.
Quite high, yeah.
And it is quite high. Now, as we look down at the river at the moment, now bear in mind this is spring, it must be nearly 20 feet below us, train going across the bridge.
That's
there.
A fair power of water getting up to this height.
But, you know, there's all these gates that you can close off to stop this particular area flooding, but you imagine the sheer volume of water it takes.
That's a lot of pressure. And what I like about it, it's quite subtle. You don't walk along this really wide boulevard and say, oh, look at these ugly flood defences. This is quite, it's nice, and they put a lovely bit of work in it. But I'm going off now, I'm going to leave you, because this area is famous for soft fruit. There's a guy just along the road, it's family business, and it's just an incredible machine. So I'm off for a wee chat.
Bye. See you later.
So I'm Liam Stewart. The company is called Stewart's of Tayside. We're based just outside Perth, between Perth and Dundee. Family farming operation, growing produce, Swede strawberries, raspberries, we grow cereals, predominantly supplying supermarkets.
So how did it all start?
So many moons ago, my uncle, who was originally here, he took the farm on from his grandfather, my great-grandfather. And in the 1970s, we were growing a multitude of different crops. So we were growing Brussels sprouts, potatoes, we had some livestock.
So just an average, smallish Scottish farm?
Yeah, just a small-scale Scottish farm. And at the time, I guess we were sort of jack-of-all-trades, master of none. And the decision was taken to specialise in certain crops that suited the climate that we were in, suited the location that we were in, and something that had a, you know, a good market opportunity. So it was decided at the time that the two main crops were Swede and soft fruit, strawberries and raspberries in particular.
Now, here we are on the banks of the Tay. You know, this is soft fruit country. We'll come on to that in a minute. But why Neeps?
Well, Neeps is one of these things that it's traditionally a winter veg and requires a lot of rain to get the crop established. So we get a lot of natural rainfall here. We get a good amount of frost, which, you know,
sweetens it up,
gives it a bit of extra flavour. But we don't get too much frost because we're still relatively coastal, you know, without being right next to the sea. So, the storability of the crop's good. And it just suits the location.
So these wee Neeps are the proper big full-size ones?
This is a man's neep, the proper Swede, as we call them. A neep is a Swede, not a turnip.
What about the soft fruit? Why is this area so good at it?
Right, so soft fruit, strawberries is our main sort of thing through the summer months. We grow strawberries from end of May through to October, November. And the reason why it suits this location so well is we're right in the valley, we're south-facing, so we get a lot of sun, we get long daylight hours in the summer, and we get a lot of natural rainfall. But we're right next to the River Tay as well, which means we get a constant source of fresh water coming off the hills, which is critical, because soft fruit, the way they're grown commercially nowadays, require an amount of natural rain, but they require a lot of irrigation, which comes from the river.
How much has it changed? I mean, you're saying it started with a small, typical Scottish farm, but hugely different now.
You know, we've gone from a small-scale family farm to a big-scale commercial business, if you like. And I guess, you know, as time's developed and growing techniques change, you know, technology plays more of a part. Technology improves every year, and the strategy's got to change every year, you know, as time develops.
And a sea of plastic.
Yeah, so...
It's not criticism, it's just the way it is.
So to grow fruit commercially nowadays, you can't really grow it outside because we can't afford for too much waste. You know, everything that we produce has got to be aimed at the retail market, which is first-class quality. So we grow it under polytunnels for the reason that it's protected. We can grow them in a hotter climate. We can grow, you know, we can exaggerate the growing conditions, if you like. We can extend our season. Traditionally going back 10, 15 years, our season was maybe 4 months long, and now we're pushing 6 months.
There's still that lingering, traditional, bleary-eyed image of Scottish fruit picking, the kids taking the holidays to go and do it. Different world now.
Yeah, it's a shame in many ways because we've kind of lost that sort of family feel, as you say. You know, it used to be, even when I was growing up, it was all local people, families, young children in their summer holidays coming and picking the fruit. And, you know, there's been a gradual transition over the past 20 years that there doesn't seem to be the same sort of appetite to do it. It's hard work, it's long hours. You know, we start picking 4 o'clock in the mornings when it's cool. Not everybody wants to do that.
Polytunnel's a scary, hot place to be.
Yeah, well, 100%. You know, if you get 25 degrees heat in a summer's day, you know, you can add 10, 15 degrees onto that in a polytunnel. So, as I say, we start really early in the morning, try and finish early so that we're not in these conditions.
So what about the future then? I mean, I'm just looking around me. You've got big, shiny trucks everywhere, and there's warehouses. It seems to be quite a complicated, well-timed organisation.
So we're maybe a little bit unique in what we do in that we grow all our own produce, we pack all our own produce here in these sheds that we're describing, and then we try and deliver all our own produce in the trucks that you see. And we do that for a reason. We like to be in control. With the best will in the world, you can grow the best strawberries, you can grow the best Swede, the best of anything, but if you deliver it an hour late or you make a mess of packing it, then you undo all the good work. So control's the key for us.
Do you enjoy it?
I love it. Ever since I've been a young boy, I've been obsessive over farming and produce and all that goes with it. And again, it's an intensive way of life. It's 7 days a week. It doesn't stop on Friday at 5 o'clock. It goes on and on and on. So I absolutely love it, and I wouldn't do it if I didn't love it.
Can you ever get sick of strawberries?
You can, believe it or not, you can. To be honest with you, I guess when you're in the environment where you're surrounded by strawberries, you know, every day of the week for 6 months, sometimes my wife says to me, why are you never bringing me strawberries home? You can get sick.
Brought your neep instead.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's us. We've made it to Perth. Join us next time for the final leg of our Tay Travels. This has been the Scotland Outdoors Podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. Thanks for listening.